So you reached me at 2:30 in the morning with our final setup. What kind of hours do you keep? And that's a cheeky way of getting into a question I was definitely going to ask you, which is, you are a musician, a touring musician, a recording musician, and an educator and a musicologist. I'd love to know how you see yourself and how you divide your time.
It just depends what projects I have on the go. If someone's asked me to do a more intense scholarly program, I'm going to have to spend a lot more time thinking about, you know, different research I'm going to have to do, pulling out the books that are needed for it, all that sort of thing. Whereas I think right now I'm really focused on like developing new music and all that sort of stuff. And that definitely keeps me up until the wee hours of the morning, just tweaking things in Logic and trying to make the sounds I want to make. It's been fun to do all of that solo since this whole thing started, but absolutely, it just depends what I have happening at any given time.
I've heard your two projects, that would the old time projects, the last record from Twee, is that pronounced right, by the way?
Twee,
and of course Spider Tales. Are you working on music that would be far afield from the old time sound and range into it, other genres entirely, or do you stay pretty focused on traditional music?
I think there's always going to be a place for both to me. I didn't start out as an old time musician, and I'm not sure that that's how I'm going to end up. But I don't know, for me, especially when it came to Spider Tales, I sort of came to this awareness that part of what I think is important about reclaiming these older traditions is also reclaiming the fact that these genres were not nearly as segregated and disparate back in the day as they are now. And part of my role as a contemporary performer can be to break down the genre divisions that we've been taught are so rigid. And I don't necessarily think I'm going to jump into like a fusion project, because that doesn't feel like me, but I definitely can see myself following different musical threads. I think that the old time sound and structure and instrumentation is always going to be a part of it, because that's something that I love so much. It's become such an important part of my musical identity. But I think there's more to be mined there, too.
When and how did you fall in love with old time, and at what age? Because it's a music that has a hard time in general reaching younger people, except for certain subcultures, certain families, certain, you know, people who are in the business and have that, you know, very much in their kind of right on their doorstep when they're young people. How about for you?
I started playing when I was 18, I suppose. It was actually just a total coincidence. So I grew up in Washington, D.C., and later on in my high school years, this festival was happening that I don't think is still happening, called Sweet Tea Pumpkin Pie Festival or something like that. That was just like the most generic early 2010s Americana festival. That would just bring all these acts to play in a bunch of different local restaurants. And I wound up going to this Ethiopian restaurant on U Street on the way to a James Blake concert. So definitely a totally different vibe there. And I ran into this band called Megan Jean and the KFB. And it was this woman playing a washboard and a guy playing a banjo. And they just had a totally different sound to anything that I'd heard before, like it, largely because he was playing clawhammer style, and I'd never seen that done before. They were the first musicians that I met who were making an honest go of it without a big major label contract. I'd never met a musician who wasn't, you know, with the bus and the arena show and signing shirts at the table after the show. I, like, helped them carry their gear out, and we chatted for a while. And they told me all about what their life was like at the time. They were living in a Honda Element and just touring constantly. And Byrne told me about the history of the banjo and that it had traveled over from Africa with enslaved Africans during the transatlantic slave trade. I had no idea. I think most people don't have any idea. We're working hard to change that. But it definitely made me think, oh, this is something I need to look into more closely. And the more I got into their music and the artists that they recommended to me, I found my way into this part of Americana and folk that felt more representative and inclusive to me, and eventually started gravitating toward older and older sounds that pulled me sort of in a long spiral toward old time music. And I got to college and Lydia Hammersley, my advisor there, was a banjo player. So I walked into her office after maybe a week of college and just said, "Hey, you want to give me a banjo lesson?" And that's how it started.
Fantastic. So it's cool. You had your cultural and music biz epiphany in the same experience, and that's pretty rare. And you did, you studied, was it folklore or musicology as an undergraduate? And then I was going to ask also, do you have aspirations of going and going further with that in an academic and scholarly way?
I studied ethnomusicology. I've never wanted to close the door to grad school because I still really enjoy doing the research, and particularly now that I'm getting to do more actual applied, like, field work type stuff. When I put on the scholar hat, I'm doing interviews and talking to people about their music as opposed to reading books. And that feels more impactful to me, especially right now, than being in a library, even though there's plenty of important things to be done there too. And I would never write it off. I would say it's not what I'm aiming for right now, but who knows? Maybe I'll turn 26 and not have health insurance and have to make a plan.
There's a lot of issue stuff I want to talk about, but of course, Spider Tales is a remarkable project and it is integrated and integral to your vision. And one of the things that I love about it, one of the many things, is that it syncs up with my with the good advice I got about writing and journalism, which was show, don't tell. This is a demonstrable lesson in the richness of the African American repertoire, which has been integrated into white country music so completely that it's been, to use the term, erased or at least obscured. But this really lets you, it creates all these new avenues. Well, if this song is this story, what other stories are there? And so tell me a bit about conceptually what this is.
Well, I think Spider Tales definitely grew out of my first EP, Reparations, in that a lot of the material that's on there is stuff that Tatiana Hargraves and I developed when we were touring that initial project, and wound up having to play shows that were longer than that 7 or 8 track EP. And some of that material sort of formed the bedrock for what Spider Tales turned into. I think I would have expected myself to make a more straight ahead old time record, looking forward on it, but that wound up being the first step in that project that I was mentioning to you earlier of wanting to demonstrate that the genre categories we've gotten so used to are sort of imposed and not things that are organically part of the tradition. And I wound up taking, you know, old spirituals that I got out off sheet music because there are no audio recordings, and I wound up taking blues queen standards and turning those into bluegrass things and lead belly songs and turning that into an old time thing. There's a broad exploration there of not just the black string band tradition, but of the full landscape of what black people were working with at the time, down to, you know, the Gullah Geechee ring shout that's on there. And I definitely can't represent all of those traditions as well as someone who's really dedicated a ton of their time into all of them. And that's why they sort of all took on a string band flavor in the end. I had to do what I knew how to do. But I think what I really wanted to show was that there are close relationships between these different styles of music. And we have to be mindful of the fact that, what we've been taught as far as bluegrass is here, country is here, old time is here, blues is here, gospel's here. All of those things were feeding into each other and learning from one another and growing together up until the founding of the commercial record industry. And by going back and sort of trying to envision what would this sound like if people had still felt like they could take what they wanted from where they were interested in and make it sound like them. To me, that was a more honest way to go about making a black string band record than pretending, you know, this one recording that this one folklorist made on this one day represents a whole tradition, and that's what it sounded like, and we can't take it beyond that. And these acting as if those artists who were recorded didn't have visions of their own and didn't have creative impulses of their own and weren't multifaceted, skilled performers in multiple genres on their own. The idea of being a specialist and exclusively doing one thing is new. And I wanted to sort of call that out and see how well I could tie the stuff together.
Fantastic description. One stylistic thing or one musical feature I really wanted to make sure to ask about was the use of the foot percussion by Nick Garess. I saw Nick at IBMA 2 years ago in one of the events that Justin Hiltner put together, and I was just absolutely stunned by his artistry. It was, I'd never seen anything like it. I'd seen clogging, of course, but the idea of being an instrumentalist and the subtlety, especially on Goodbye Honey, you call that gone, the opening track, absolutely one of my standout tracks this year. It is amazing to me. One of the freshest things I've heard. Tell us about Nick and about why that foot percussion got on this record.
So I've like had a dream of working with Nick ever since I heard, like, saw videos of Nick when I was just starting to play. And I got lucky and met him after one of his shows at the Irish Arts Center in New York when I was like a sophomore in college. And he was super nice and supportive and has just like been present as a friend and a collaborator and just a gem of a human being the whole time. And when I was coming up with this project, I also realized, right, I'm trying to break down all these barriers and question why we've been sold the idea that old time has to look this way, bluegrass has to look this way. Nick is someone who has the facility required in many different styles to sort of bring the percussive dance element back into it, right? At a certain point, we got sold the idea that percussion didn't belong in this music, which to me, on a musicological level, is like a pretty anti-black stance, right? We don't do a lot of stuff that doesn't have rhythm. We do some stuff that doesn't have rhythm, but not a lot. And I've always felt like that was a big part of what I needed to question, this idea that there is no beat, there are no drums, and that Nick can do that and also be working off of this traditional black dance form that went with the music and white dance forms. Nick has done, you know, 10,000 different things and done them all well. I felt like it was really important to include that there. And I think he brings a similar perspective, but from the opposite side, where he frequently characterizes musicians as dancers with prostheses. I just thought it was great to be working with someone who could help, who was already, even before I got to this point, doing the work of breaking down those dichotomies and trying to figure out how we can have a more holistic picture of what these traditions should look like, of who's involved in the traditions, and also of how the different pieces interact. It was totally intuitive to ask him to be on it, and I'm super glad he said yes. His tracks on there are some of my absolute favorites.
Spinning over to history here, I watched a talk last week by Stephen Lewis, who's a curator at the National Museum of African American Music. Their programming has been great as they crank up to their opening this fall and winter, I hope. And he told the story that I've heard many times about Ralph Peer sort of innovating or creating the schism, the original schism in country music between race records and hillbilly records. And I'd heard the story before, but as he told it, the question occurred to me about whether this was a split that probably would have happened by someone else in some other influential position in a record company back then, or if in fact he really set something in motion that did lead to a great deal of loss of potential collaboration, repertoire, mutual understanding, a much different country music industry. And it related too to a set of recordings I've always cherished, which were Eddie Lang and Lonnie Johnson playing blues guitar And those records came about in 1928 and 29. And as I have read the history, that is the earliest or among the very earliest commercially released biracial duet music. And then I discovered that it was released in Europe using their real names and released in the United States with a sort of blind boy, somebody or other pseudonym for the white guy so that they could sell it as a race record and not somehow cause a stir, I guess. You have any thoughts about that? How did Ralph Peer really shift something that wasn't solved, you know, kind of how consequential was that move?
So I haven't read the book on Ralph Peer either. This is a part of history that interests me, is something that influences the places where I tend to specialize and focus my time, but it's not the thing that I've read the most about. I will say, I think all these things can kind of be true at once, right? Ralph Peer kind of did a bad thing. I also think had he not done it, someone would have done it, because I'm not sure how you sell music to a market as segregated as America was at that time, and in some ways still is, without participating in that to some degree. And the rest of the industry still follows that model, right? You look at which popular artists are categorized in different streaming platforms, different music marketplaces as pop versus rap. You look at who's country and who's blues, right? The early Carolina Chocolate Drops records are listed as blues in a bunch of the early stuff. I mean, I have blues on it, maybe one or two songs. But the fact is, I think the genres are still in some way racially constructed. And there needs to be discussion of that as well. Ralph Peer may have been the originator, but he's not the end point. And there's a larger picture that he's a part of. At the same time, I also want to acknowledge that there's, I think, this popular idea, especially amongst old-time musicians, bluegrass musicians, etc., that before Ralph Peer came along, everyone was kind of hanging out, learning tunes from one another, and it was all good, right? There was this climate of like mutual understanding and everyone hanging out. I think that is maybe too optimistic of a way to view the Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction South, that during that period, folks were interacting across the race lines, but one, they couldn't do it socially without breaking laws. In a lot of the states that we're talking about, it was legally not allowed for black and white people to mix socially in many of these places. But two, even when they were, do we know that the trading and mutual learning of music traditions was happening on a level playing field, right? If you're a black musician and a white person comes up and says, teach me that song, you can't tell them no at that point in time. So I've always felt there is probably a deeper narrative there of exploitation and of people one-sidedly taking the musical traditions of another group that we don't always talk about. We don't talk about the fact that we have a lot of black musicians who talk about playing for white square dances. We don't have any white musicians who talk about playing for black ones. And we don't hear about integrated dances, right? So there was still some level of racial stratification that existed before Ralph Peer entered the picture. I think that he codified it in a way that was super harmful, but the circumstances may well have predated him, and it may have happened regardless of who made the recordings or when.
Mm-hmm.